There's no excuse for overdose deaths from opioid-based medications. Most of the adverse effects associated with overdose from opioid-based medications could be easily prevented or rectified by simply making naloxone more widely available. It seems as if the medical establishment is afraid that letting people know that their overdose can be quickly and effectively reversed will give patients a green light to abuse their opioid medication. Undoubtedly, it will for some, but for most it should not, and there's no doubt that it would save thousands of lives. For those of you unfamiliar with this life-saving antidote for opioid overdose, naloxone hydrochloride, proprietary name Narcan, is a selective narcotic antagonist that rapidly and effectively reverses the effects of opioids, including those associated with overdose. Specifically, it will reverse the respiratory depression, which is responsible for most opioid overdose fatalities. As long as the circulatory system has not collapsed and the naloxone is able to reach the brain, it binds preferentially to opiate receptors, blocking the effects of heroin, morphine, oxycodone, methadone, hydromorphone, fentanyl, opium, L-alpha-acetylmethanol. Well, you get the idea. It blocks the effects of opioids. Naloxone has no effects in people not receiving opioids. It simply blocks the effects of illicit and illicit opioids, regardless of who or why the drug was administered. Yes, I know about the endogenous opioid peptides. I've written a paper or two involving these neuromodulators myself. But the effects of disrupting the endogenous opioid peptides are disappointing for those of us neuroscientists who were hoping back in the 1980s they would hold the key to virtually everything from overeating to forms of mental illness. Naloxone is virtually unnoticeable in somebody who has not been receiving opioids, and it has a very wide safety margin for dosing in humans. It's shame on the medical establishment for withholding this critical information from the public. Should the medical establishment and even individual physicians be held responsible for the needless deaths? Is it their decision to make who will live or die based on the availability of this life-saving drug? And why aren't patient advocacy groups confronting the medical establishment, lobbying more strongly and unrelentingly for take-home naloxone? Naloxone's been around for a long time. In fact, my first publication using this compound was in 1977, when I, along with Professor Larry Reed, demonstrated that naloxone hydrochloride effectively and rapidly blocked morphine's facilitatory action on reinforcement from electrical brain stimulation. I continued on using naloxone for many of my experiments during the next two decades. There are certain precautions that must be exercised when using naloxone, and proper medical training is strongly advised. There are self-instruction cards included in some naloxone rescue kits. The attempt to reach more people that don't have access to medical training is not a substitute for proper medical training when it's available. Two of the most important areas for concern involve the precipitation of intense withdrawal reactions and the short half-life of naloxone. Naloxone administered to a person physically dependent on an opioid can precipitate immediate and intense withdrawal reactions. What is normally an unpleasant but relatively safe experience can quickly become a medical emergency, even fatal. The usual procedure is to give naloxone in graded amounts, increasing the dose if the overdose victim does not respond within a few minutes. The lowest effective dose of naloxone is desired because it minimizes the adverse effects of precipitated withdrawal. The second area of concern is naloxone's short half-life. The half-life, of course, determines its duration of action. Unfortunately, it's much shorter than that of most opioids. Because naloxone only blocks the opioid's receptor occupancy and does not eliminate the opioid from the body, when the naloxone antagonism wears off, there may be sufficient amounts of opioids remaining in the system to cause the victim to relapse back into a coma and die. For this reason, hospitalization and careful monitoring, even in patients that seem normal and who feel totally revived, is essential for the well-being of the overdose victim. One of the realistic fears that healthcare workers have is that if people are revived without the aid of trained medical personnel, they will simply ignore the warning to seek proper medical attention. It's the responsibility of those with the overdose victim to ensure that proper medical attention is sought after they're revived. Dial 911 immediately. On-site resuscitation with naloxone is not an excuse to avoid immediate professional medical attention. For those who are concerned about getting into trouble for the heroin overdose, consider how much trouble you or your friend will be in if you're dead. Furthermore, naloxone is not a CSA/DEA-controlled substance, nor is having an illicit drug in your bloodstream an illegal act, to the best of my knowledge. But then, I'm not a lawyer, so I'll rest my case on the first argument. You'd be in more trouble if you did. New York State is to be commended for being among about a dozen U.S. states and several European and Asian countries where naloxone rescue kits are legally available. Unfortunately, while trying to fly under the radar of possible adverse public opinion, New York and other states make it difficult to find information about this important program. The public needs better education about the nature of drug addiction, and while we're at it, we need to educate Americans' physicians better as well. And of course, politicians need the proverbial fire lit beneath their butts to get them moving and starting to change attitudes about harm reduction. It's ironic, perhaps, to some people that these rescue kits are mostly available to illicit drug users, and the aging baby boomers being increasingly prescribed opioid-based medications do not usually have access to this program. Well, at least it seems ironic to me. The baby boomers being prescribed opioid medication are among the least likely to abuse these kits in any sense of the word. I've been advocating take-home naloxone for years as part of a general harm reduction strategy for illicit opioid users, but now there's a whole new group and generation that could benefit from this policy as well. Patients prescribed opioid-based medications who are sometimes overdose victims need access to this important life-saving drug. This commentary is focused on this new group, although my position on naloxone as part of a comprehensive harm reduction strategy remains ever strong. Perhaps there should be a warning to politicians regarding this issue, like the warnings that appear on the opioid-based medication bottles. Caution: prescription opioid users vote. Finally, I have to state the obvious because I know this is going to escape the attention of too many people. It's not just about the accidental overdose in the person prescribed the opioid-based medication. It's also about the grandchildren, who despite one's best efforts find and play with the pills, and about the little puppies, who quickly grab and devour anything accidentally spilled on the floor by fumbling old hands as if it were a tasty treat. These are the other potential overdose victims, perhaps even more deserving of our concern. This information is not intended as medical advice, nor is it a substitute for proper training. It's strictly intended to bring this topic to the forefront of attention and to argue for the more widespread availability of take-home naloxone. Write your state and federal representatives in support of this program and acquire and learn how to use an naloxone rescue kit wherever they're available. The estimated cost for one of these kits is under $10. I'm Dr. Michael Bozarth for the Addiction Science Network. These podcasts are copyright 2012 by the Addiction Science Network. They are produced in collaboration with the State University of New York at Buffalo and are provided solely for educational purposes. Podcasts can be directly downloaded from www.addictionscience.net. Transcripts are also available for some podcasts at our website, as are other documents and commentaries regarding drug addiction and select topics on psychopharmacology. These podcasts can be copied and freely distributed as long as the source is acknowledged and provided they are not edited in a manner which changes the fundamental meaning of the selected passages when quoted out of context of the entire presentation. Correspondence from professional colleagues is welcomed and can be sent to info@addictionscience.net. We do not offer clinical services, nor do we usually have time to reply to questions emailed from the general public. When listening, please keep in mind that these podcasts are targeted for academic and professional listeners. Everyone is invited to share any information they find useful, but our target audience is not the general public. Finally, please note that the Addiction Science Network is the sole author of this work, and views and opinions expressed herein should not be construed as official policy of the State University of New York.